So they came to me one day and said, "We'd like to get married. We think we do, anyway. We think we want to get married. We think." Which was not spoken with a bold stroke of confidence. And two, they were both middle-aged, and they had done a considerable amount of life already. It turns out they had met and had been seeing each other for a short time, and both were carrying a considerable amount of a thing called a past. And apprehension was thick upon their faces. Hers was rather complicated. Being single all of her life, she was nervous and apprehensive and angry for some reason, which is never an easy thing to sort out. For she could be gentle and congenial most days, but those flashes of anger would show up, sometimes without a moment's notice, and it was part of her question, should I get married? And in the mix of it all was her Christian faith and a negative self-image of herself, and where do those come from? And loneliness was there, her face was drawn tight with years of practice of being alone, and should we get married was her question. His life also had some complications, but of a different sort. His face bore a serene faith, but behind those sunken eyes was a deep pain. He had been born into a family of strong Christian conviction and family values, with Bible reading devotions every night and praying and impeccable church attendance and a Christian college where he met his Christian wife. And divorce had never entered his mind. That is what worldly people do, not us. But what do you do when your Christian wife turns out to be a serial cheat? And prayers didn't solve any of it. And the church teaching never to divorce, clinging ever tightly to your conscience. And after being jilted many times and after divorcing her twice, to be hurt again and gingerly cautious and carrying a Bible shame of rules not kept, to come with her to say, "We want to get married, we think," which was not spoken with a stroke of confidence. You heard Rochelle read these words earlier, and language people who take the pains to dissect such things have claimed that the Bible book of Isaiah contains some of the absolute best poetry in the world, bar none. Which is probably like why its words like, "I'm doing a new thing," can stick in the mind and can sneak right on past religious shame brains. I listened long to this couple, and I did not have any answers for them, not easy ones anyway, but I did ask them if they've read any Isaiah, like in 43:9, "See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness. I am making a way in the wilderness." And the short piece we heard read again this morning, "I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered," were important words for this couple to discover, for their minds had been trained to think, "Bad boy, you're doing it wrong. Bad, bad boy, you're doing it wrong. And bad girl, if you marry him, you will be doing it wrong too. You will be scorned. What you gonna do?" When in fact, the mind of God in Isaiah has been to make a new way in the wilderness, to create something new, to turn and to face the sun rising up in the sky. If you've been around here for the last 3 weeks, you now are well aware that we are in our third week of exploring this one phrase, the way of Jesus. This phrase, the way of Jesus, appears in our newly constructed vision statement. And there has been some intrigue with this phrase. So to recap, we noticed in week one that the earliest followers of Jesus were people called the Way. That comes in the book after John that we call the Acts. The activities of the apostles, their way. And we noticed, too, that for those of us who grew up in traditions reciting the Apostles' Creed, that it jumps straight from born of a virgin, suffered to Pontius Pilate, with only a very large comma in between those lines, which leaves no trace of Jesus' life, And is it okay to recite that? Is it okay to memorize it? But nonetheless, there was something going on with these people, these early Christians who got called the people of the way. And last Sunday, we suggested that God's fingerprints are all over creation and that it's good. And God's fingerprints are on human lives, our human lives, and that that is very good. And that God can be extended even further when our fingerprints bless and heal the world. The title given to this morning's theme is Wayfarer's Travel, which literally speaking might come off as a little redundant. I mean, what sense would it make to say that wayfarers stay put? Of course wayfarers will travel. They will make moves. That's what they do. But maybe the title Wayfarers is also a little misleading if we only think in terms of simple geography, like going from Greencastle to Harrisburg, or from Jerusalem to Corinth, or from Harrisonburg to Wichita. I mean, it's one thing to be an aimless vagabond, a nomad, a high plains drifter, going from one place to another. You can be a gypsy-like person and not be Jesus-like. So it is quite another thing to have a direction, a horizon to face into. To those of us, and I know there are some of you here who came of age in the 70s, might remember the phrase that appeared on quite a few college dorm posters and on walls, which was, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life," which is a saying meant to steer our toes from yesterday towards the future and face the horizon. And you can hear the same sort of thing in Jesus' words too, a kind of threshold. Jesus saying, "Come to me, all of you that have grown weary and with your burdens, come and learn from me, and I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls." It's another way to go. And you can also, if you want to, hear it in traditional wedding vows that say, "To have and to hold from this day forward." We stand here on this day positioned to move into a future. And yes, the couple that I mentioned earlier did get married. Last Sunday, we also paused to do some word fussery. We fussed with two English words, action and holy. Since Jesus came to this earth before the English language did, it's always worth taking a minute to search for Hebrew meanings and for Jewish understandings. Last week in 1 Peter, we found the word holy, which I did say in rather unceremonious fashion is an English word that is getting close to wearing out its welcome. For too many think holy means to be perfect, which, newsflash, we ain't. Or holy is thought by some to mean sinless, which, newsflash, get over ourselves, we ain't. But that a closer understanding of the Hebrew word kadosh is to be God's representative, set apart to begin duplicating God's fingerprints upon the earth. Last Sunday, I also pulled a word from 1 Peter, the word action, which is hardly a word that we need to fuss about at all. It means movement or travel. Prepare your minds for action, is what we heard. So representing God is not a mind game or a theory postulated for our minds to latch onto. It is an activity. It travels. Holy has an itinerary. All right. Moving into today, and more fussery. I only have one word to fuss with today, and the word is disciple. And I'll ask you please to stop your yawning. I know, we already know what disciple means. Move it along, preacher boy. So like any kid growing up in a church, I did have a question or two along the way, and one day I asked one. It had more to do with the mechanics of what I was hearing, of how to get to heaven having my sins properly forgiven so that I could get in there in due time when the time came. Though as a kid, I did have better things to do most days than to fuss about this, better things to do than to consider the big questions of existential angst. What with haymows and ponds and apple orchard, apple slinging and catfish, fishing and sledding and rivaling my siblings on most days, I did have more to do. But nonetheless, there did come a day when I thought maybe I should pop this question, which was, if it is true that only those whose sins are forgiven get into heaven, then what would happen if I had confessed all my sins like a good church boy, and then one day I did something really bad, a sin, and Jesus came back before I had the chance to have a really bad sin confessed and forgiven? Where would I end up? And the person I asked said, well, sorry, but I guess you would end up in hell. And I would now facetiously want to ask of us, is that what we mean by inviting the faces we see each day into the way of Jesus? Now, truth be told, please know that because I grew up on a 300-acre dairy farm with lots of space, I did have plenty of other good things to distract me. My question didn't linger long, didn't scar me much, I don't think, but then there did come the day while sitting in Dr. Solanki's seminary class, Dr. Solanki, who was from India, saying to us that over here in the U.S., we have a rather distorted view of the word discipline. You think it means to punish or to deprive yourself of something. And he went on to say that discipline is very connected to the word disciple, which is a learner, which is an apprentice, like a village father wanting to teach his child his trade, like a village mother wanting to teach her child her trade. Correction and practice and correction and practice is more the sense of it. A big, no, you're trying to do it this way. Try doing it this way, like that, yeah, like that. You're getting the hang of it. Can we imagine Jesus operating that way? And yes, frustration and goading are part of the gig, but also joy. Ask any parent, ask any teacher. And it had been decades, but that was the day in class where my long-ago mentally filed away childhood question came rushing back to the surface, and suddenly Jesus made more sense to me, much more sense, that when I was reading my Bible and things like, follow me, and my yoke is easy and less burdensome, come along with me and I will show you, things like, work out your salvation, for it is God who is at work within you, enabling you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. For me, it turns out that following Jesus was less about the mechanics of getting myself through heaven's gates, and much less about figuring out the statute of limitations on my sins, but more about imitation, mimicry, that to be a Jesus disciple came with this freedom to learn from him and to fail on occasion and then to learn some more whilst here on earth while heaven waited. This last week, Jean Vanier passed away. He was 90 years old. He was the son of a Canadian diplomat, and his first big choice in life was to embark on a naval career. He served in World War II, and then after that, a rather odd thing. In 1950, 5 years after World War II ended, he resigned his commission, saying that he wanted to follow Jesus. So he went away to study. He actually did doctoral studies on the subject of happiness. He studied happiness. And then he became a teaching professor at St. Michael's College in Toronto. And it was during his teaching career, during the Christmas holidays in 1964, that he was visiting a friend just outside of Paris, France. And his friend was a chaplain for men with learning disabilities. And Jean became disturbed by the conditions by which 80 men did nothing but walk around in circles all day. And so he bought a small house nearby and invited two of those 80 to join him to live in a small house nearby. And L'Arche was born. Homes for intellectually disabled that now numbered 147 across 35 countries. Jean Head says that living with the disabled helped him appreciate two truths. One, that people with learning difficulties have a great deal to teach us. Two, living in community with people with or without disabilities, we open ourselves up to be challenged and to grow. How about that one, Marian Mennonite? And you almost have to tip your brain sideways to understand what is now being said about him after his death. One interview earlier had said, Gene taught us the great wisdom that resides in tenderness. Great wisdom resides in tenderness. That handicapped souls have something to give back to us and teach us. And how am I doing with that one? And another thing about Gene, he said that there is an unusual power to be found in gentleness. Gentleness as a kind of dignified power. And how am I doing with that one? Or how am I doing with another turn your brain sideways Bible verse that says, for when I am weak, then I am strong. These things that we learn from Jesus as we practice them. Now, last week, Carl mentioned the passing of Rachel Held Evans, and this week I am giving a nod to the passing of Jean Vanier. We don't do saints in the Mennonite tradition, and perhaps there are historical reasons for it, but truth be told, there continue to be Christian people for whom we do sit up and take our notice of them. Lives lived well who have taught us something. Rachel lived to be 37. Jean lived to be 90, but the stretch of their years hardly factor into it at all. Both of them began in one place and ended up in another, and so much took place in between, in their minds, in their hearts, and in the places where they dared to tread. And maybe the very helpful thing that we can take from both of their lives is that wayfarers do indeed travel upon this earth, and that it was the travel that made them attractive. And in the end, for us to know that if we choose to walk our lives with Jesus, we are likely to end up in a different spot than we are today, and that it will be noticed.